So, to a lot of people, AI seems like magic. Is that it's okay, you're training the AI can think now, the AI is self-aware, blah blah blah. It's you could just as easily call AI artificial intelligence, or you could call it artificial stupidity. Because like to me, the definition of stupidity is that you know you're probably wrong, but you act anyway.
Welcome to the Enterprise Intelligence Podcast with the CEO of ShinyDocs, Jason Cassidy, and VP Customer Success, Davey Sliman. Gentlemen, welcome back.
Yeah, Steve. Yeah, it's good to see everybody.
Start of August.
It is the start of August, which in a sense breaks my heart, kind of feeling halfway through the summer. And I actually packed a bit into the summer. Like it's early on, like did a race with my son. Mm-hmm. And so got out for a little bit, which was kind of fun. And then we've been doing a lot of business lately, which is fantastic. And I think a lot of people wanted to get stuff wrapped up before August. So yeah. That's good news. And then, but when August is finally here, it's a bit of a sigh. It's too bad. And I don't know if we feel good about the fact that summer's feeling half over. But here we are. Want to keep things up.
Doing it kind of European style, isn't that very classically European to have kind of August be the big long sort of quiet time, kind of maybe classically sort of Germany. I think a lot of Germans take the Dutch take a lot of August off and that kind of thing. Yeah, you've had a busy June, July for sure. If you think about all the training leading into the race itself. I know a little bit about how busy you've been otherwise. So that's it's been jam packed for you.
Yeah,
put your feet up a bit.
Maybe, yeah. I do have some vacation booked in August, and it's funny because most people feel like the Christmas holiday or whatever whatever Christmas is to you, that 2 weeks is the transition between years, and it's almost like August is kind of the transition between years. You know what I mean? It's like you start fresh in September to work hard, whether it's at school or work or whatever, and then you plow through until the end of June, and then hopefully you get the summer off.
Yeah, I've always felt that way. The September kind of Labor Day cutoff is kind of a refreshing, you know, kind of, I don't say do-over, but like it's classically coming out of, at least here in Canada, coming out of one school year and into a new school year. And it's been decades since either you or I have been in school, but that actually kind of stays with you. And then you can even tie it further back to, you know, farming and harvest and things like that, right? It's like, it's the end of the growing cycle. It's kind of when you get fall fairs and start eating apple pie and fattening up a bit for the winter. And no, I love it. It's one of the fall is actually my favorite time of year. I love the fall. It's exciting. There's lots going on. I find the summer a little sleepy sometimes, but
it's okay. Yeah. Yeah, we don't need to resolve this debate today. So
it's a gooder though. I'm happy to get started if you want me to start.
For sure, yeah.
So I want to talk about robots, but not people are going to think robots like, you know, assembly line robots or science fiction robots. Those aren't the robots that I'm talking about. What I want to talk about, well, actually, I'll set the stage a little bit. There's a concept out there that I'm sure you guys are probably very familiar with, but maybe not everybody is familiar with, which is called screen scraping. Do you know what I mean when I say the words screen scraping? As an aside, I had a colleague years ago who used to mispronounce it screen scrapping. And then they said it so long that way that nobody corrected them. It would have been weird if we corrected them. But screen scraping is this process by which you or somebody writes a software program that goes off and looks for content, usually on a web page, but it doesn't have to be on a web page, and essentially scrapes or, you know, claws off the content from a web page to be used for some other thing, right? And kind of classically, the things that they would be used for would be to publish content on another website, which is this thing that I'm sure some of you guys have seen where you go somewhere and you read a movie review on one website, and then a week or two later, you're on a completely different website and you're reading the exact same article. That's because the whole thing's been scraped and lifted and moved somewhere else and that kind of thing. And that's, I don't want to say a good use of screen scraping, but it's certainly a common use of screen scraping. And then, of course, there are nefarious reasons why people use screen scraping for illegal purposes. They're going to scrape a screen and grab banking information or financial information and that kind of thing. But what I wanted to talk about was this thing that just came up this past week where Reddit, a very, very large, very, very popular site, has basically started to put up blocking robots using the robot protocol set out, actually, ironically enough, I think by Google, around the robots.txt file.
Robots.txt, yep.
To tell specifically Microsoft to stop using Reddit as Reddit screen scrapers as a way of training AI. You know, and the part that's, you know, kind of, you know, got people kind of salivating over this story is that these are kind of mega players, right? So there's the Google's robots.txt file, you know, associated with Google. There's Reddit, which is one of the biggest kind of, you know, public web platforms that there are out there globally for people to share everything with each other. And then, of course, you got Microsoft, who was discovered not illegally, but was discovered nonetheless to be using the content on Reddit web pages to train an AI. And so the gist of this whole thing is not Reddit saying, hey, don't do this ever. But what they're saying is, hey, pay us. You want to start scraping our stuff and using Reddit to train your AI? That's super cool. Here's our pricing model. You can start to do this right away. And this is what it looks like. So, you know, I found this whole thing, I guess, kind of both unsurprising and fascinating at the same time. But it made me worry a little bit about, you know, these are mega platforms and mega corporations. It makes me worry a little bit about the organizations that are out there that aren't these mega kind of institutional players and the effect that this could have on their willingness to be open, to be transparent, to be public about what they're doing. If there's this fear that, you know, the giants of the industry are just going to go off and scrape all their stuff and use it to train their AI without paying for it. So I found this story kind of, you know, juicy from the point of view of who the players were involved in this, but also got me thinking about, you know, the little guy and how the smaller players out there could be really negatively impacted by this. So initial thoughts, comments?
Yeah, it's so because I thought you were going to go to like RPA or robotic process automation. We can talk about that some other time or never. That's fine. The first thing that comes to my mind as we talk about this screen scraping or whatever, I'm gonna take an alt and I'm gonna try on this position because I think we've talked about it in the past of like, does Ken Jennings, when he went on his tear within Jeopardy, and I get that there's a few others that have gone on similar tears, but I mean, he was the first, you know, mega star to go make millions on Jeopardy itself. Does he owe everybody except for FedEx a royalty because he used their words as part of the answers to the questions to the answers that were given? No, he acquired that knowledge from Wikipedia, reading books, from the internet, and all that kind of stuff. And so when you train a robot and it acquires knowledge, is that the same as your first example, which was, I'm going to republish verbatim some content? I think that I will posit that they're definitely different use cases, and I'm not even saying that the second one, the idea of training an AI, should be treated copyright differently, but I'm just saying that they are different use cases. So do we consider that a robot learning something is in any way different than Ken Jennings or anybody else who wants to learn trivia? It's just learning. It's not copying for the purposes of reproduction. It's copying for the purposes of learning.
Well, and to take your position kind of to the next logical step, I would say that copying for the purposes of just copying and putting it on another website and passing it off as your own is weirdly, in my head, worse than teaching an AI to do something more interesting with it. Do you know what I mean? Like you're essentially saying, I'm gonna scrape the shinydocs.com website and I'm gonna put all the contents of the shinydocs.com website up on davieslemon.com, and I'm gonna put a new font and color around it and a new logo, and all of that's gonna be my content now. That to me feels worse in some ways and more kind of duplicitous, or whatever the right word is, or just lousy, than an organization saying, I'm gonna go and crawl this website, I'm gonna scrape all the web pages that I can find on this website that we know to be full of subject matter experts and really knowledgeable people and people that know the answers to things. And then I'm gonna use that to train a thinking robot or a thinking AI on that data so that we can come up with something better and more valuable. Like I first of all, I think on some level, the second thing is more interesting to me, but I think in both cases where I keep coming back to is the propriety of that content in both cases is the original owner of the thing. So without any doubt in my mind, I've never clicked on the fine print on the Reddit website when I sign on and create an account. I'm assuming something in there says that Reddit owns anything that you put in there, right? So anything I type into Reddit as Davey Slimmon isn't mine, it's Reddit's, I assume. And so,
or at least you imbue a license to, in a royalty-free license for them to monetize it.
Right. Yeah. I have to imagine that. I have to imagine that's what they've put in there. Not having the end user agreement in front of me, but all Reddit is really saying is not that they're against the idea of Microsoft doing this, but rather they're against the idea of Microsoft doing this and them not getting compensated for it. Which, again, I'm back on not being that surprised by that. And also, you know, maybe that's where all this is going, and that what you could see the beginnings of is a kind of new, maybe not a new economy, but maybe a new market for knowledge, with that being sort of the stated end goal of creating a community of knowledge, or a collection of thinking on any given topic. Just like 20 years ago or 25 years ago, companies would get created. People would start companies with the stated goal of getting acquired. We're going to build this company, and the goal is to get so much to a certain point in revenue, certain point of customers, so that we get acquired by Microsoft or HP or IBM. We're purposefully building our company to be acquired. You could just as easily see companies say, we're going to set up a platform and environment that is so deep in subject matter expertise and knowledge because of the people that participated in it and the content that's there, that our stated goal and plan is for people to pay for their AI robots to come and crawl this stuff. And it's fascinating to me, because of course, you know, the first place that people go for this kind of thing is, how can we turn this into money? How can we monetize this?
So yeah, for sure. So the fun thing is that it's back to like Arthur C. Clarke or something like that, is that any sufficiently advanced technology seems like magic. And I know I probably busted that exact phrase, but the gist of it is intact. So to a lot of people, AI seems like magic, is that it's okay, you're training the AI. The AI can think now, the AI is self-aware, blah, blah, blah. It's you could just as easily call AI artificial intelligence, or you could call it artificial stupidity. Because to me, the definition of stupidity is that you know you're probably wrong, but you act anyway. I undertrained for the event, or I didn't train for the event, but I was still going to go do it. That's stupid. You know what I mean? I didn't look before I made the turn, but I turned and floored it anyway. Totally. And that's what AI does by when I think of my journeys into Reddit, the fourth thread that I read is the one that actually has the accurate answer that I'm looking for. In the first three have a bunch of idiots who like to respond on Reddit who don't first. Know what the hell they're talking about. Exactly. And it's just, yeah, or they try to restate the question in a dumb way. And it's just, and the problem is that the computer, the way it's designed, artificial intelligence, all it does is it says when it just knows when this type of prompt is given, this is the type of response that people give. Whether it's dumb or right. So in the event, like lots of questions where only 25% of the answers are actually in any way accurate, that's what we're training this stuff on. So where I'm headed with this, because I mean, I think we're dancing around copyright law, is that I own as Reddit both the copyright to the intelligence and the stupidity on my platform. If you could demonstrate to me that the robot is truly just learning, actually sussing out the real answer, the accepted answer to questions, the Ken Jennings, if you will, because Ken Jennings has different vectors that he uses to validate that this, in fact, is the trivia that I need. He just doesn't read the first thing on Reddit and accept that that's the answer. That to me is the difference from a copyright perspective. If you're truly generating intelligence, if all I'm doing is reading your Davey's work, Davey wrote a book and I read your book and now I'm smarter because of it, I owe you no copyright. Whereas if my intention is to get the gist of how you produce stuff and then I use that gist to reproduce stuff, that to me is derivative work. You're just creating a derivative work.
Sorry, I'm just going to chime in here, guys, because I'm fascinated by anything kind of legal related and copyright related. And yeah, I think there's an interesting discussion about when you're looking at things like this, scraping websites from like what's public and what's private standpoint. Mm-hmm. And like, I think an argument can be made that like Reddit, regardless of, you know, Davey, what you said, what's contained within their, like when you agree to their sign up form.
Public site.
It's like, I was going to say, it strikes me as kind of like a town square, like environment, right? Like it's like your thoughts or your answers to things that you're putting out there, you're voluntarily putting out into the public space. So it's like, it's almost like if I was watching TED Talks, if I was just sitting watching TED Talks on YouTube for free and then learned a bunch of stuff and then went and wrote a blog about it, it's like, am I now like financially, do I owe those people who did the TED Talk? Because it's like, I've learned from what they were saying. I think there's a really interesting, you know, there's that differentiation between like, if me as a human being and Microsoft's AI as an AI are doing the same thing, but like, why is it okay for me to do it? And why is it wrong for like that to do it in the sense that we're both absorbing information that's publicly.
If I go onto Reddit and I learn how to fix my toilet, cause I don't know how to do any plumbing, but I go onto Reddit and I go to the explain it like I'm five section and I learn about how to fix my clogged toilet, you know, am I taking advantage of something? Do I owe somebody $5? No, of course not. Go ahead, Jason, you were going to say something.
Yeah, for sure. You're right. But I think fair use already covers this.
Yeah.
So if I watch a TED Talk and I write something that is criticism of it, and criticism broadly meaning it could be lauding it, saying it's great, or it could be like a critical review could mean I'm positive or negative. It doesn't matter. So, but it's criticism is covered under fair use in most Western law, maybe everywhere. I don't know. But if you were creating a derivative work, then you can't. So like if you took, and I think the public square metaphor isn't quite apt either, because it is definitely the fact that you have to click through a agreement before you can access it completely nullifies the public square argument. Is that like a public square is truly like there's even restrictions on what I can do at the town hall that I can see from our building here. However, it is public. I can wander on there, and as long as I'm not specifically breaking the law or loitering or whatever, I can be there. However, This is like a private backyard that we're talking about. So Reddit can make the rules as to what you can do in their private backyard. And if you go into their private backyard and you're inspired to create your own backyard that doesn't include their content, but it's inspired by it, that's fine. That's fair use. That's, you learned about it, and then you use that learning to create your own original work. Mm-hmm. And I think the trick is it truly derivative? Whereas AI is definitely derivative. The way it's coded right now, it's just, what's the most likely word? Well, Reddit told me the most likely word to come next is this one. That's a derivative work, in my opinion. I'm not, this is not legal advice. Stamp that on the screen at this point. Yeah. But in my opinion, it's a derivative work. So I think Reddit has a pretty strong case in this case, unless you can truly change the algorithm to be doing fair use, to demonstrate that it's just learning. And then it can create its own original works based upon that learning, as opposed to just guessing, you know, I'm going to use similar words to what such and such did.
I think that opens a really interesting conversation with AI generated artwork.
Yeah.
Because then it's like an argument can be made that it's creating like it's creating its own thing, but it might have, you know, I'll use the word stolen for lack of a better phrase, like stolen the style or the subject matter from like artists who have put work out into the space. But I mean, I don't think it's unquestionable to say that in that case, it's generating something completely new.
Yeah. Right. So we're three smart guys and who are pretty,
that's like your word for it.
Pretty, I'm going to say progressive and open-minded. Like it's, sure. I can get my mind changed about anything, but please bring evidence, not opinion. And based upon that, we're having a pretty comprehensive and complex, I'm not going to say argument, but I'll call it argument for the sake of using a correct word. So imagine your average politician who maybe they're intelligent, maybe they're not, but their job is to get reelected, not necessarily to govern well. So how would you expect them to be able to have a good argument about this? Because we're really counting on them and then a court to interpret it, because I mean there's no precedent in law in this that's overly comprehensive as far as I know. So it's funny that if we can't nail it down on this call, I am very suspicious of the ability for any type of legal framework to nail this down either, other than to arbitrarily rule based upon whatever influence that they have at that time.
Yeah, 100%. I think policy-wise, I think it's not outside the realm of possibility that there are all kinds of policy wonks in DC and in Ottawa that are pondering these very topics. In Canada, we've got Michael Geist. I don't know if you know Michael, but people like that who think on these topics all the time. The challenge is, of course, that policy and law and all these things move at a glacial pace, you know, and by the time they put together a policy thought that turns into something that is a bill or something that gets debated in the House or gets debated in the Senate, time has marched on. It's like, you know, like it's just, you know, all these companies, all these stories have just completely marched on, and it becomes a big nothing burger at that point because the cat's out of the bag. I do think, you know, and I didn't get as far into the details of, at least the article that I was reading didn't go into the details of what Microsoft was specifically doing, but it is interesting to me that they chose Reddit as the target of this AI, not merely because Reddit is this giant platform full of words and sentences and that kind of thing, but because of the upvoting and downvoting, right? Reddit's whole thing is that the community not only gets to write whatever they want, everybody in the community gets to say, yeah, I agree with that, or no, that sucks. And so if you're training an AI, I have to imagine that the upvotes and downvotes are potentially part of that as well. Of course, the joke may be on Microsoft because people will upvote anything with a cat picture and downvote anything that doesn't, right? So, you know, whether it's a useful way of training an AI or not, I don't know, but it is interesting nonetheless. So,
yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. It was like, it's, I remember the original version of that was Hot or Not, if you remember that website from the 90s.
Yeah.
And or the early aughts, if you will.
Yeah.
And any male had a really slim chance of being over 70% hot. However, if they were holding a baby, that every one of them holding a baby was over 70% hot. It was funny.
Yeah.
So the algorithm can be gamed by all sorts of interesting things.
100%.
It's not a definitive as to whether or not that means it's the right answer.
Yeah, I still, you know, the thing that I still kind of chuckle about through the whole thing is that at no point did you know, the lawyers, et cetera, the leadership from Reddit say that they were particularly wounded by Microsoft doing this. They were wounded by Microsoft not paying for it. You know, it's like, yeah, totally. Go crawl all this stuff and, you know, scrape all these pages. That's cool. It's just, we would like to be compensated for that. So anyway.
And I think that brings up an interesting point, and this might be a dumb question for me, but do you think a solution, if people are truly worried about, you know, their content being scraped by like an AI, is, you think we'll see more things get hidden behind paywalls?
I do. That's kind of where, I apologize because I kind of didn't lean on that maybe enough earlier in this chat, but I do think that's that is a potential outcome of this, is that people will think more carefully about the stuff that they make public, which is, you know, sort of back on your comment, Jason, about being progressive and being evidence-based and fact-based and all these other things. I don't want that. I want, if anything, a more open and transparent society full of data and full of facts and full of all these things. And if these kinds of things cause individuals and organizations and corporations to be more secretive, I'm not excited about that. You know?
Yeah. And I'd be curious, even as an example, if like something like Wikipedia, like it was like a dollar, like you had to pay like some ridiculously low membership, but just to establish like that sort of paywall to just stop AIs from scraping this stuff, right? Would people fuss? It's like, oh, and I got to pay a dollar for this thing that was free. Or would people be like, good, because now I know that, like, you know, whatever my contributions are aren't being, you know, essentially taken to train an AI.
Well, let's say that it's not Reddit. Say that it's the Mayo Clinic. For many people's estimation, the best, if not one of the best, research hospitals on the planet, certainly in the United States. Do you start to think differently about the kind of research data you're publishing? Do you start to think differently about every page that you put, every press release that you put out, every single thing that you put out about cancer research, about vaccine research, about all these things? Do you start to think differently about all the stuff that you put out? Maybe right now you don't, but maybe you start to think differently about all these things. And you know, I think all the time about what it is that I find important in my life and what I want to be involved in, you know, for the rest of my life. And for the most part, it's about the war on ignorance. Like I just, more than anything in the world, I want to be involved in fighting ignorance and stupidity. Because I see it on the rise, and even in some cases being celebrated, you know, celebrating, you know, the sort of anti-science, anti-intellectualism, which I find absolutely terrifying. And if these kinds of forces are pushing what I think of as progressive organizations into a posture where they're not going to be as interested in sharing their knowledge and not be as interested in sharing what they've learned, that's worrying to me. So.
Yeah. It's, man, this is a big one.
That is a big one. Sorry.
Yeah, geez. I think we're going to have to leave this one unresolved.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, I think there's a good one. Talking about combating ignorance is a whole other,
totally.
I'd jump all over that topic too. So yeah. Like, well, preserve this for a future episode.
Big time. Yeah. What do you got, Jason?
Yeah, this is almost similar to the cloud CloudStrike, so it's kind of like CloudStrike 2. July the 30th, it's a lot of systems that I use regularly were failing quite a bit. And sure enough, it was revealed that there was distributed denial of service attack, taking down a bunch of Microsoft servers or services, Azure, and a number of things. And like for me, it kind of healed itself over time, like the services, and I'm not going to list them off because I don't want people to go hack me or search me anywhere in these different systems that I was using or services. But it was just interesting to watch how many different things that we rely on every day for commerce melt down yet again. And in this case, because of a malicious actor. So if a company's what we call a boo-boo, well, I don't want to say incompetence, but CloudStrike, oops, we miscompiled some code or whatever. And then some actual malicious intent from people who weren't insiders, it's in the Microsoft case, there's so many things that can just bring us offline. And there's this fragility that, again, I was told that when we get to the cloud, everything's going to be more robust and these types of things aren't going to happen anymore.
Yeah.
And they're just happening every week now. It's over and over again. So again, I don't want to crap on cloud. I don't want to crap on Microsoft. Obviously, I'm going to alt on it and say very good companies and a good idea for products. But at the same time, it's just the zeal by which there's so many people, and this is kind of the combating ignorance, goes, we're cloud first and we're cloud only and we're only going to do this. It's like, man, it's just...
Have you thought about it?
Have you really thought about this? Yeah. Like, man, there's certain workloads that absolutely belong there. But God, it drives me crazy when everything goes offline at once. It's because there's some single point of failure associated with this. And I think maybe the combat that I want to say is it's not that it's Microsoft and Azure and those types of things that go down. It's just that they let themselves be a single point of failure.
Yeah.
For some reason, their authentication goes down and it goes down for everything. So whether you're on a Zoom call or you're trying to get into your CRM or whatever it is, you're dead. You get disconnected. So that's kind of my issue. It's not about the amazing distributed nature and economies of scale of cloud. It's the fact that we just let these organizations implement single points of failure into this big distributed thing that was supposed to fix us. So
do you think that we're approaching a time, and I won't tell you what I think, but I'm curious to hear what you think. Like, are we approaching a time when there will be an appetite for the citizenry, but then by de facto, then the politicians and people who make, you know, laws and decide how governments are going to run and that kind of thing. Are we approaching a time where there will be an appetite for the infrastructure that we're talking about, which is a combination of satellite infrastructure, fiber, cloud writ large, etc. Do you think we're approaching a time where there'll be an appetite for that to be more greatly regulated than it is today, in the ways that drinking water quality is regulated, or in the ways that, you know, electricity is regulated? Because those things are, there are regulations in where we live that govern how municipalities serve potable water to people to make sure that there's water that's not going to poison people. There are regulations in place that govern how electricity is distributed and what is considered to be critical infrastructure. And yet, you know, there has been, well, first of all, this sort of gradual march of deregulation really since the 80s, but this gradual march of deregulation across all sectors forever. And when it came to some of these newer technologies that we're talking about, and you're talking about cloud, for example, you know, they're just non-starters. They're like, well, you know, we're not going to treat these things as critical infrastructure the way that we would for giving people clean water to drink.
Yeah, it is like, and so when I think of the engineering, because it's, you know me, I like to posit the engineering mindset for things that are critical to our lives. So a lot of that came from, like, we're in Canada, Canadian Railway was built, and there was kind of this line that says, of the immigrants that were brought to build the railway, it was anticipated there'd be about one death per kilometer of railway.
Right.
Through accident or food deficiency or whatever. That was kind of baked into the P&L for building a railway. And at some point, somewhere around the, you know, like between 1915 and 1930, a bunch of, you know, good-natured people said, we should have rules. I don't know exactly when occupational health and safety came into play, but it was around these times when mechanization was really taking foothold, when things like electrification was new and interesting, and there was companies who did this and they were innovative and they, you know, competing. It's you got Tesla versus Edison and stuff like that. And like, if you didn't do it a particular way, people would die,
right?
Just by design,
right?
So there was particular ways to do these things. And that was great. And that, and when you think of water, when you think of electricity and other utilities, high pressure gas and all that, like, obviously it's all steeped in that regulatory environment. Mm-hmm. And then along comes the internet,
right,
and connected technologies that are associated with it. And there are some things like aviation and others that heavily rely clearly on you know, this connected tissue. Mm-hmm. But I think because there's not this straight through line that says that, you know, unless you follow this policy, you're literally going to die. Like, I didn't die on July that.
Yeah. You're saying it's because it's life. It's not life and death.
Yeah.
Your internet is unavailable for a little while, so you can't do banking for a few hours.
Yeah, exactly. So, however, $100 or $500 million leaks out of the industry. A bunch of people don't get paid. A bunch of people don't get to their destination. So there's a value associated with inconvenience,
yeah,
that we're willing to tolerate.
Yeah.
But there is, as long as people don't die, so that's kind of the threshold, I think.
You're right. I think you're onto something there. You know, that, yeah, you know, but that's the part that... this is going to be my cynicism coming through. That's the part that kind of surprises me, because my cynicism tells me that people would be more upset about the productivity and financial cost than, you know, a few people dying. But maybe that's my cynicism speaking. Like, you're absolutely right. Like, if, you know, think about even just, you know, I was thinking recently about the gigantic East Coast power outage that occurred in, what was that, 2002, three?
Yeah, about that.
Something like that. Remember that?
Yep. Yeah, started in Ohio and then worked its way all over the place. Yep.
Right. And that was it a full day for a lot of people? It was a full day, I think, for me. It was
way more. Yeah, we were heading up to the cottage at that time. So we were at a cottage with no power, and then driving back home, there was no gas at any of the gas stations because they need power for invoicing and even to operate the pumps. So
I
had to make sure you had a full tank of gas back then.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was 2 days for me. It was at least a day and a half.
Yeah.
It's funny because I remember because my parents were visiting relatives in the US and it was my brother and I home alone.
Right.
Wow, freaking out about everything in the fridge and freezer.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. You know, like, I can't, sometimes it's long enough ago. It's so long ago that I can't remember how long it lasted, but it was around that time frame. And I think you're right. I think it was like a day and a half or two before my power came back on in Ottawa. Somebody must have done the math on how many billions of dollars this cost the economy. Not just for, like, I'm not talking about just fixing whatever caused the problem. I assume that cost a lot of money as well. But the lost productivity, the time, I'm sure there were deaths. I'm sure there were incidents, absolutely, where I know that in many cases livestock died, right? All the mechanized and automated systems for feeding cattle, all the mechanized and automated systems for HVAC and temperature control and all these things, lots and lots and lots of lost dollars. I that's the one that kind of, like, did anything come or change as a result of that? I don't know that it did. We made that's a research project for another day, but it's kind of weirdly in the same direction of what we were talking about with the kind of outages that you're talking about, Jason, with CrowdStrike, et cetera, where it's so widespread and so pervasive and grinds modern society as we know it today to an absolute standstill. And, you know, so why aren't we taking that more seriously as something to be worried about?
Well, and
I just,
yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, Jason. I just looked up quickly to see if there is like data on the financial impact of that blackout. And they say just in Ontario alone, it costs nearly 19 million hours of work.
Yeah.
And 2.3 billion drop in manufacturing deliveries.
2.3 billion in Ontario.
It's... apparently it caused a 0.7% decline in Canada's total GDP in a single month.
Yeah. So almost a single point of GDP. Wow. Crazy.
Yeah. So this is neat. It's almost like politics enters every one of our chats.
I don't do it on purpose.
Yeah. No, it's okay. It's just inexorably linked to progress. So you think about, okay, you're offline, and there's a way that there was something wonderful about that being offline. I remember power was out, and I kind of got I figured out that this was going to be a long thing, maybe on the radio or whatever. And so I went over and I picked up my grandmother and said, you're sleeping at my place tonight. So we had a barbecue. Everybody in my neighborhood had teak torches out. You could hear conversations. Everybody was outside. It was beautiful. Yeah. Then we're all offline for a little while. And it was a very cooperative thing. We went a little feral for a couple of days. It was, you know, people, you know, helping each other out with food and all that. It's the way society should be. And commerce kind of all shut down at once, and then it all booted back up again at once. And then I look back at the pandemic, mm-hmm. which was handled way differently, how politicized it was. And some people saying like, it's, well, there is, can you imagine if anybody was running around saying there is no power outage? This is a global conspiracy. The power is still working, and they're just
the left wants you to be lazy.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what the hell? It's so anyway, and obviously, like, if you think of the pandemic, it was trillions of dollars that was lost in productivity. But if we look at the way, like, if you think about how electricity was handled for those 2 days, nobody paid any bills. Nobody did anything. And when it all booted back up again, we all gave each other a pass for 2 days. It's like, you didn't show up for work. You didn't pay your bill. Nobody cares. Just shore it up. We'll be fine. Whereas over the pandemic, we tried to Frankenstein everything. It's like, okay, well, you'd still have to pay your rent, but you're not allowed to use the building. And then we'll have some rent subsidy that you have to pay back. And some of you will get a check for some amount of money based upon some arbitrary criteria, and then you have to pay that back maybe. And it was just this complete mess, when perhaps the blackout should have been the model to say, hey, guess what? Commerce is done for a week. We're just done.
Yeah.
Okay. We're pausing everything for a little while here. And I don't mean commerce per se, like still buy food or whatever. But it's just, you don't have to pay your rent. The bank isn't going to collect on anything. You don't have to pay your mortgage. You don't have to, because nobody could during the blackout, and nobody cared. So maybe a pandemic should be modeled that way, where it's literally just all of this commerce just needs to be paused, other than, you know, basic life skill things like food and water. That's kind of it.
Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. Yeah. It's I think it made.
Well, I 100% agree with your sentiment, and you know, I think you're absolutely on track. Do you think that the difference between the two? I mean, you talked about the politicization of it. Do you think that it has anything to do with expected duration. And here's what I mean by that. Like, you know, the power goes out in 2002 or whenever it was. Was it 2002, Steve? Whenever that was. Power goes out. And you know, I think even at the time, even though it was super loosey-goosey and people were stressed, it was 2003. You know, even though people were really stressed and there was a lot of misinformation coming out and it wasn't easy to get a straight answer, I think everybody assumed it would be coming back on because this is a power outage and they'll figure out which telephone wire needs new wire and they'll add new wire and then it'll come back on. Whereas the pandemic, I remember, I don't know whether it was the same for you guys, I didn't work at Shiny Docks before the pandemic. I worked elsewhere when the pandemic started. And I remember the day that we were sent home from work. I was at work when they said, oh, you know, we're just, it looks like, you know, they canceled all these NBA games and, you know, it looks like this is a real thing. I left like a mug of coffee on my desk. I left my jacket. I left a bunch of stuff thinking, oh, okay, well, all right. I guess we're going home. I'll be back in a couple days. And I never went back. I mean, sorry, that's not true. I went back to go get my coffee mug. I went back to get my
jacket. Yeah, sure.
But that was it, right? And so to me, the other axis of this problem is how long can we do this? Because I think to your point about like everybody giving everybody a pass and being like, you know, don't pay your bill or don't worry about it, blah, blah, blah. I think that's all with this sort of like back part of your brain that says, this will be over quickly. We'll get through this together. Whereas the pandemic turned into, as we know, something altogether different.
Yeah. So, and it's, so again, it's a political conversation as, I didn't have much of an inside track on the pandemic. And I recall this very vividly is, right away I talked to a friend of mine, Dr. Marty, he's a doctor in Orleans near you.
Yeah.
And, he used to be a military pilot and then he decided I'm going to be an engineer. And then he decided he was going to be a medical doctor. So
well, I think you've talked to me about him before. Yeah. Marty, yeah. Fascinating guy.
So when I talked to him that spring and said, okay, what's going on? And he just explained, he goes, this isn't much different than it was during, you know, like the Spanish flu, as they called it back in 19, whatever the 16 or 17, whenever that was. And yeah. He said, we're in no better shape. We don't have a vaccine. We don't have these things. So it's going to be in and out of, as waves of infections happen, we're going to be in and out of quarantine for probably the next 2 or 3 years. And he was telling me that like right away, like in March.
Wow.
When we got together. And I'm like, well, that's interesting. That's not what I'm hearing on the news. Right. And when I came back even to my team here at Shiny Docks and was talking to HR and others saying, well, this is what my trusted source says is going to happen. They're like, no, you can't say that because it'll make people feel hopeless. So you got to just say that we don't know and we'll reevaluate every 6 weeks. Until then, stay home, try to work, and we'll try to accommodate you. And I'm like, okay, well, that feels like a lie. But I'm not going to lie to people, but I will say, sure, like because none of us knew for sure. But deep down, I think lots of people who were in the know knew for sure that how catastrophic this was going to be. And of course, you can look at Bill Gates's TED Talk, if you want to talk about TED Talks again. He prophesized the whole thing, and no, he didn't cause it. For those tinfoil hat people out there, he's not a proprietor of coronavirus anyway. So shortest story, very, very long. It's what I think about is that you got to step back and just be brutally honest with yourself.
Yeah.
And like, as a society, it comes back to the fighting ignorance. It's like, oh no, we need people to have hope. We need people to have this or that. It's like, no, let's actually deal with the danger that's at your doorstep right now. Right. And part of it is you don't need the financial stress associated with this. So if nobody has to pay their mortgage,
right,
then nobody has to pay the rent and nobody has to do this. And you can kind of keep track of things because power still needs to flow and there's other kind of stuff and you can shore it up at some point in the future. But what I'm getting at is that the way that we did it was so dumb. It's like weird lending that some people are entitled to, other people weren't entitled to. And then, landlords kind of got this or that. And it was just, it was so silly when, quite frankly, it's, you could have just phoned the banks and said, hey, guess what, banks? You're not collecting anybody's mortgage for the next, until this gets resolved, and then move to the next step. It's like, okay, well, what is that problem? Does that cause? Okay, you guys don't have to pay them, and it's follow the chain down.
Yeah.
But no, nobody had the nuts to do that. Everybody's like, oh, can you imagine if the banks didn't make a profit this quarter? How bad that would be for society. And so we don't care that 1% of the population is going to be dead in a month, but it's just, like it's, imagine how bad it would be if the bank didn't make a profit. And then, so we invented all these weird lending rules and dumb crap. And we ended
and systems that were more complicated than they needed to be, right? I mean, you know, and your point about, you know, delivering a message that is true, however unpopular, still feels like the right thing to do. Like, to me, it feels like the right thing. You might be unpopular by saying something that is factually true, but that's ultimately a better thing to do than delivering the thing that's going to give people hope, but that's false. You know, I don't know. There's it, as in many things, we can bring it back to Lionel Hutz from The Simpsons with, you know, Marge, there's the truth. And the truth, shaking heads, nodding head, you know, exactly. you want the smiling truth that everybody wants to hear, not the frowning truth. That's the thing that nobody wants to hear.
Yeah. That house is on fire. No, it's a motivated seller.
So good.
Yeah.
So there's always a Simpsons for it.
We do live in the era of alternate facts. So
exactly. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Man, this was a good chat. Yeah.
Good chat. We resolved nothing, but it's, as always, we covered a lot of good ground. It was a good thing.
I love it.
Yeah, great discussion, gentlemen. We'll pick it up next week.
Love it. See you guys. Okay.
Take care again.
Enterprise Intelligence is a Shiny Docs podcast with Jason Cassidy and Davey Sliman, produced by Stephen Schuntz. Copyright 2024. If you would like to learn more about how Shiny Docs can make it easy to organize your content, protect your data, and make your users happy, visit shinydocs.com today.